Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
The Chancellor might have hailed yesterday's budget as a tax cutter.
Because we are delivering the Prime Minister's economic priorities, we can now help families not just with temporary cost of living support, but with permanent cuts in taxation.
Despite this, though, most of us are paying more tax than any of us have ever known. But could some of us still be paying more? And by some of us, I mean the super rich, of course, not me. Take the Prime Minister himself as an example. Worth hundreds of millions of pounds, but pays the same effective tax rate as a teacher or a nurse.
Tax records have shown that the Prime Minister earned over £2 million last year, which amounted then to over half a million he had to pay in tax.
Yeah, the documents revealed he paid an overall tax rate of 23% in the UK.
All as it should be. Under the current system, he pays income tax at the higher rate on his £139,000 salary. But most of his income, we know from his published tax return, came from investments, which is taxed as capital gains at a much lower rate. Is this right? Or should the super rich be squeezed for a bit more to level the playing field, to help lower the tax burden for the rest of us? Or will that kill investment and see them pack up their private jets and Scarpa? You're listening to Stories of Our Times, from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Luke Jones. Today, the pros and cons of a rich tax.
I'm Lily Russell-Jones, and I am a senior money reporter.
Why are we talking about the idea of a wealth tax now? I mean, why is it in the ether, do we think?
We're all paying a lot of tax at the moment, so the tax burden is at its highest level since the Second World War, and the economy's not been growing fast enough. So even though we have this high tax burden, it's not really able to keep up with the amount of spending that we need. There's a lot of pressure on public services, things like the National Health Service, schools, local councils. They're really strapped for cash. And I think that's why there's this question of whether people who can afford to pay more should.
And how have we ended up in the situation where we have this enormous tax burden?
I think most recently, the main factor is the fact that most tax thresholds have been frozen in place since April 2021. And basically what that does is that as your earnings rise in line with inflation, the tax thresholds don't. So more people are getting dragged into paying a higher rate of tax. One of the reasons that there's a need to tax more is because of the amount of borrowing that happened during the COVID-19 pandemic. So the national debt is now worth over the value of GDP. So it's like the debt is worth more than the economy, and the interest payments on that are huge. So the government does need to find money from somewhere to pay for that. That's one of the reasons that we're being taxed more.
And the curious thing about the way we're taxed, though, at the moment, which is leading to some people to call for a wealth tax, is because we're taxed on income, on earnings, not necessarily if I'm sitting on a big pile of cash or an enormous house, which I've had for donkey's years.
Right. So we do have some taxes that the rich have to pay, which can target that wealth. But yes, you're right. If you're sitting on it, then there's not necessarily a tax which is going to capture you. So there's capital gains tax. So if you sold your assets, you might have to pay tax on the profits. And there's inheritance tax. So if you die and you pass that money on over a certain limit, then yes, that gets caught by tax. But yeah, you're absolutely right in that it's difficult to target wealth specifically. It's mostly income.
Hmm. So to put it bluntly, if I have an enormous property empire worth £10 billion, which for some reason generates no income for me, I'm not being taxed on that.
Technically, I suppose not.
So the idea of a wealth tax is out there in the ether. You might think one person who'd hate the idea of being taxed more is somebody who has a lot of money. But here's someone who's earned millions and millions and is not just open to the idea, he's actively campaigning for it.
My name is Gary Stevenson. I'm the author of the new book, The Trading Game. I was formerly Citibank's most profitable trader in the world, and now I'm an inequality economist.
Is it fair to describe you as a wealthy person pro-wealth tax?
Oh, it depends who you're asking, but yeah, I'm definitely wealthier than most, and I definitely am supportive of a wealth tax for sure.
Yes, and you say that you got to the point where you were the most profitable trader at Citibank. Of course, it wasn't always the case. Can you rewind for us right to your upbringing? I mean, was it a wealthy household you grew up in?
No, definitely not. So I grew up in Ilford, which is a kind of a East London, Essex contested territory, to a pretty poor family, to be honest. Small terraced house, backed up against the railway that went in from Essex into the city. Yeah, not a lot of money to go around. It was pretty tight, to be honest, when we were kids.
Did you notice that as a child?
When I was a kid, my parents sent me to the Esso garage down the road with the £1 coin to buy some lemonade. And I dropped it. I dropped the pound coin at some point. And just remember just searching everywhere, under the cars, in the drains. You know, this strong sense that we don't have much and we don't have a pound to lose. You know, I was definitely aware of it.
Did you have aspirations at a young age, do you think?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%. You know, ever since I was a very young kid, I had this kind of ability for maths. And I always did very well in school, even though I wasn't really studying. And those Canary Wharf tower blocks were going up when I was a kid, that we could see them from the street. Mm. And you just kind of think, well, that's going to be me. I'm going to have a nice fancy corner office in one of them skyscrapers. Being a banker, whatever a banker is. I didn't really know what it meant at the time.
Yeah. So does that mean that you did well in school then? I mean, were you a good pupil?
I was a very good student. I had very good grades up until the point where I was expelled for drugs. When I just turned 16, I think I'd sold £2 or £3 worth of cannabis.
You were trading?
Well, you know,
early
we
trader.
Talk about this. We discussed a little bit about this in the book, you know, like it's true I was the one that brought it in, but you know, so I passed my 11 plus and I went to a fancy grammar school. You know, I had to, you know, a bus ride the way. And you know, I was one of the poorest kids in the school. I didn't have no money, but I could get drugs. And this school was full of kids that couldn't get drugs, but they had a lot of money. So there's a trade right there, isn't there? And, you know, it's the kind of trade that means I'm the one that gets kicked out.
Well, and as you say, kicked out, but it didn't necessarily affect your grade. So was then your onward education and entry into the job market smooth, difficult?
I managed to get back into one of my local comprehensives, and I was able to get into the London School of Economics. And it was there that things became a bit more serious about how do we become a trader now.
And how quickly did you get into banking after you left uni? I mean, was it quite quick?
My last exam was on a Thursday. It was called Chaos in Dynamical Systems. And I started working on a Monday. So before the financial crisis, Citibank used to hire one trader a year through a card game, which is basically a math game.
Through a card game?
A card game,
honestly,
yeah.
The financial crisis makes so much sense when you hear things like that were going on, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, you say that, but they got me from it and I was their best trader.
Oh,
fair enough. It worked out, you know.
And so it was literally a card game that they would make you play a game.
It was a card game. But when you break it down, it's a maths game. And to me, that meant a lot because the main way that these banks hired back then, and I think still now, is CV and cover letter. And, you know, I looked around myself at LSE and I'm surrounded by kids of millionaires from all around the world who've been president of the Junior United Nations or, you know, played oboe at the Royal Albert Hall. And here's me selling drugs and fluffing pillows in a sofa shop in Beckton, you know, how are you going to get in? I think in the end, a game is probably fairer in terms of a class perspective than the way that they normally hire their trainers. So there was me, 21, very young, bought all my work clothes from Topman the weekend before, turning up as the youngest trader in the city at the time.
And is trading where you make the mega money? I mean, when it was going at its best,
yeah.
what was your annual winnings?
I only worked full-time as a trader properly for 4 years. The number I had in my head that I was looking to make was £2 million. And I managed to get through that.
Through that?
Well, I didn't stop exactly on £2 million, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You get bonuses and, you know.
Yeah. When did it all start to unravel for you and you start to thought, this isn't quite what I'm after in life?
After the 2008 crisis, everybody was saying V-shaped recovery. And that's because interest rates were reduced so much during the 2008 crisis. Everybody was saying we're going to have such a big bounce back. And I watched 2009, didn't happen. 2010, it didn't happen. And 2011, I was sort of sitting, having witnessed basically these millionaire economic geniuses be wrong about everything for 3 years. And I started trying to figure out what is actually happening. Why are we not getting the recovery? And I had the one of my sort of trading idols, a guy called Billing, basically aggressively told me, if I want to understand what's happening in the world, you've got to go out and ask people. You've got to go. And he said to me, go home and ask your mum. Go and ask your friends' mums. You know, walk down the street. Look at what shops are closing down. I started asking people, you know, why are you not spending money? They all said, I don't have any more money. And I started looking into it. And what I saw when I looked around me was a generation of people, I was in my mid-20s then, whose parents owned houses, but they themselves would never be able to afford to own houses. What you see really is the disappearance of middle-class wealth. Then at the same time, 2011, that was the year of the sovereign debt crisis, when it was revealed that governments all over the world were basically going bankrupt. So what you see is ordinary families going bankrupt, governments going bankrupt, and I'm surrounded by multimillionaire traders.
And what does that do to a person?
Well, what it did to me was it said, you've got to put a bet on that the economy will never recover, because once inequality is growing, listen, if these guys can't keep their house when they've got a house, what chance do they have when they don't have a house? If the government can't run a balanced budget when it's not massively in debt, what chance does it have when it is massively in debt? It's a death spiral, isn't it? It's that once you kill your middle class, then it's a straight slope down to hell, basically, and things never get better. And I knew immediately that I can make a ton of money off of that. So I think what you see here, this is the start of the conflict where you realise society is going to collapse into poverty. And I think, unfortunately, the last 13 years since then have done nothing but prove me right. And you then also realise your job is not to fix that, but to make money off of it.
And there are lots of people who would be okay with that, wouldn't they? They'd say, great, I've got this insight into what's happening. And yeah, it's grim for everyone else, but I'm about to make an absolute packet. Press on.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you decide to do?
You bet on it 1 year. And then that year I was the top trader in the bank, and it's kind of surreal. You watch it happen another year, it works really well, and you start thinking, maybe I'm right here. And then you start thinking you've got a responsibility. And I walked into my boss's office and I said, I want to take some time out. And then he said, they started throwing money at me wildly.
How wild?
It was pretty wild. They moved me to Japan and they gave me a big salary increase and they gave me a big fancy corporate apartment. But I moved to Japan 6 months later. I walked into my boss's office again and said, listen, I'm out. You know, at that point in the time, I was struggling with quite bad mental health. My weight dropped down to about 8.5 stone, which is, you know, I'm not a big man, but that's not a lot even for me. And I wasn't really in the best state of mind, but I did it. And I'm here now talking to you. I'm not locked to a screen in Canary Wharf somewhere.
That was Gary's life. Now he's an economist and an inequality campaigner. What is his take on the idea of a wealth tax that's been floating around?
I mean, it's something I actively campaign for. I actively campaign for wealth taxes. So the thing you need to understand is these guys make 5 to 10% of their income, right? So, you know, let's take Rishi Sunak, £700 million wealth. That's his approximated wealth. If he makes 5% every year on that, that's 35 million quid. 35 million quid passive income just for getting out of bed.
You mean just on like interest on that cash?
Interest, dividends, rents, you know, profits on the companies that he owns. Yeah, it's his passive income. He doesn't need to do anything. That is, you know, that is what happens when you're wealthy. You know, I'm nowhere near as wealthy as Rishi Sunak, but I'm also able to live off my passive income, right? And if these guys have this enormous amount of excess income, in a growing economy, maybe that's going to go in towards building new stuff, new investments. But we don't live in a rapidly growing economy. So what they end up doing is buying the assets from the middle class, buying the assets from government, lending money to the middle class and government, which puts them into greater amounts of debt. And what you end up doing, these people start acting as black holes, essentially, sucking the wealth out of the middle class and government. And I think we live in this age, I mean, especially in the last 5 years, where we've seen massive collapses in private wealth, ordinary living standards for middle-class families, enormous collapses in government wealth. At the same time, the largest and fastest ever increase in wealth for millionaires and billionaires. The average billionaire made 22% in the first year of COVID. They increased wealth by £630 million on average, each individual. You cannot allow all of the wealth to flow away from middle-class families and towards the rich and not expect the middle class to become poor. You know, you simply have to be aware of the way wealth flows through society.
But is that not an argument for taxing their income a lot more? And what you just described there as being the passive income, so what you get from dividends and the interest on savings, that is all taxed as income at the moment. What we're talking about here is just nibbling away at a chunk of the base wealth each year as a wealth tax. I mean, that's taking it forward even another step, isn't it?
If you want ordinary families to be able to access wealth, you need to have wealthy families selling wealth. Realistically, that's what you need. And if these wealthy families have £35 million a year passive income, they're never going to sell anything. And taxing their income, it doesn't cut it because, you know, even if you were to tax his income at 50%, and we know Rishi Sunak paid 20% last year, he's still got £17 million passive income. He's still never going to spend anything. If you want wealth to flow through society, you need to create a situation where rich people have to sell assets. And if you never, ever force rich people to sell assets, then you will never, ever allow ordinary people to buy assets.
The counter argument, though, is you could go too far and make them entirely sell up what they have in the UK, which might be a house or two, and actually take all of their wealth abroad somewhere in one of the many countries where they don't have a wealth tax. And then we don't get any of the benefit, do we?
I think this argument relies on a kind of a conceptualization of rich people, as if rich people kind of have this enormous bag of money that they can move around wherever they go. The reality is, you know, rich people don't get money from their work. They get money from their assets, houses, property, businesses, debt. I think the best example is Roman Abramovich. The government loves to say we can't tax rich people because they can move. Suddenly they decide they want to tax Roman Abramovich. And it turns out it's not so easy to put Chelsea Football Club into a bag and take it to Moscow. Listen, these people are the least financially mobile people in the world. If Rishi Sunak makes £35 million passive income, where do you think it comes from? We could tax those profits at source. You know, it's a farce. These guys are taxable.
Is Gary right? Or could a wealth tax actually scare off the rich? And aside from that, how would it work? Coming up, we'll go back to Lily, our senior money reporter.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Lily, you suggested this idea of a wealth tax that some people are talking about. When we say a wealth tax, what does that mean? What are some of the features of a wealth tax?
One idea that's been explored is an annual charge based on the value of all of your assets above a certain threshold. So that would include things like your pensions, your property, your investments and your savings, minus any debts which you need to pay, such as a mortgage.
So to return to my £10 billion property empire, which doesn't generate any income, I would then be charged an annual tax just on the fact that I'm sitting on £10 billion worth of property.
Exactly. And I think that part of the idea is that it would encourage someone like you to try and repurpose your property empire to try and generate money so that you could try and use that to pay the wealth tax.
Well, I'll keep that in mind for my empire. Is there not also the issue, which you sometimes hear about, of asset rich but very cash poor types? I'm thinking about some of those documentaries we've seen where you've got these aristocrats who maybe own a £10 million castle, so would be above this proposed threshold, and yet live in one room of it and have a 3-bar heater because they can't afford to actually even keep it up, rather than, you know, let alone pay a tax on the value of it.
Yeah, I think that's another really good point, is that a lot of these assets which would count towards your wealth are not liquid assets. So you can't just give the tax man part of your castle. Mm. You would have to sell it or monetize it. But this is also used as an argument for it, because people say, well, people would be encouraged to use their assets and use their wealth in a way that's more productive, so they can make money to pay the tax. So if you had loads of money in a bank account, you might be encouraged to invest it and help a new business start to grow, because you know whether your money is just sitting there or whether it's actually being used to do something good, you're going to have to pay this bill at the end of the year. So I think that it can work both ways.
When we talk about wealthy, there are different ways you can slice it, isn't there? Because you can have high earners, and then you can actually have people who don't earn much but have a lot of assets.
Yes, I think that that's a really good distinction, because high earners will be paying quite a high rate of tax. So our highest tax rate is 45% for earnings above £125,140. And there's also an effective tax rate of 60% when you earn between £100,000 and £125,000, because you lose your personal tax-free allowance of £12,570. So you actually end up paying sort of a whole load of your income through tax once you get to a certain level. But this is about other types of wealth and how you try and target that through taxation. As you say, people who are asset rich and have things like £1 million pieces of art hanging in their home, or as you say, your property empire, or
because it's already a bit of an imbalance, isn't there? I mean, we saw this with the tax returns of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer when they were published, that we saw their salary taxed as you'd expect and as you explained along the lines of those income tax bans. And yet money that they had earned from their investments was taxed at a lower rate because it was capital gains.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So there's a disparity between the amount that you get charged in tax when you make money from income that you've earned through work versus when you make capital gains through the sale of assets. So a basic rate taxpayer pays 20% on their income, but would pay 10% on capital gains. And higher rate taxpayers pay 40% tax on income. Additional rate taxpayers pay 45% tax, but both of them would pay 20% for capital gains. And then there's a max rate of 28% if you sell a property which is not your main home for higher and additional rate taxpayers, and then 18% for basic rate taxpayers. But the bottom line is that if you are earning your money through income and you're working for it, there's a higher tax rate than if you're selling assets.
Yes. And so the idea of a wealth tax then is suggesting almost a third channel to that. So if you've got income tax, which is tax which is on your earnings, you've got capital gains is when you dispose of assets or sell them. This third way is just taxing it just sitting there.
Exactly. I think that people see inheritance tax as one way of doing this, but obviously that only affects people after they've died. And so this would be a way of taxing wealth during someone's lifetime.
Has this kind of wealth tax ever been proposed before?
Yes, it has. It's got quite a rich history, but Labour actually included it in their manifesto ahead of the 1974 general election, which they won. And they did try to introduce a wealth tax, but opposition to the plans and practical difficulties in drafting the legislation meant that they never actually brought it into place.
And take us through then into the debate about why you would bring one in or not. What are the pros, first of all?
Researchers have estimated that a tax of 1% on wealth above £10 million would raise £11.9 billion a year, and it would only affect around 20,000 people. So it could lead to a fairer society, so less inequality, by taking some wealth away from the very richest people and sort of using it to support those who are less well off through things like public infrastructure. So in 2020, the richest 10% of households held 43% of the UK's wealth, while the poorest 50% held 9% of the wealth. Mm. And then I think some of the cons is that it would leave everybody worse off because the wealthiest people in our society would then leave the country and go somewhere where the rate of tax on their wealth is going to be lower. And the Institute for Fiscal Studies, I spoke to Stuart Adam. He said that he thinks an annual wealth tax would create economic problems because it would distort people's saving decisions. And there are practical problems of trying to value everyone's assets each year to work out how much tax they owe. Just the administrative burden could be huge.
Yes, for this to work, would my £10 billion property empire have to have someone from an estate agent come round every year and say, oh, actually, it's worth 10.3 this year?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big ways that this starts to look a bit impractical. You know, working out how much is that painting in the attic worth? Yeah. Am I going to be taxed on that?
Yeah.
It becomes quite difficult. Not impossible, but there are practical issues to it.
And I guess the last thing we want to do is give estate agents any more lucrative work. But I mean, this is all very interesting, but is it at all in the offing? I mean, is either the Conservative or Labour Party genuinely toying with this in 2024?
It has been something that was proposed by think tanks. However, when we're talking about the two main political parties, there's really not much inkling that either would back a wealth tax. And in fact, in August, the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, explicitly ruled out introducing a wealth tax if Labour wins at the next election.
Yes. And so, yet still, if people feel like the wealthiest in society need to be taxed more, and we don't like the idea of a wealth tax, and we don't want to put up income tax across the board, the second one that you mentioned of capital gains, of which, as we've discussed, Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak have, as we've seen in their tax return, been taxed at the usual lower rate from the money that they've made from disposing of investments. Is there any political clamour for upping capital gains, equalising it with income tax even maybe?
Yes, I think a couple of think tanks have said that equalising the rates of capital gains and income tax would be a good way forward to make sure that wealth is being targeted as well as income from work. However, one of the main arguments against doing that is that when you invest and you're making capital gains, you're taking a risk with your money, and they want to encourage people to do that to help businesses and help the economy grow. Mm. And also, you might have a situation where you've already paid tax on income that you've earned, and then it gets taxed again through capital gains after you invest it. And so people might see it as unfair to have double taxation.
One of the other things being floated, if we're in a mood to tax the wealthiest in society a little bit more, is to scrap some of the rules for non-DOMs. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, so I think the Conservatives are introducing new rules for non-DOMs or non-domiciles. Those are people who live in the UK, but for tax purposes, they're registered as living overseas. And currently, they pay tax on income that they earn in the UK, but not on sort of anything they earn from abroad. So the government is scrapping that, an idea which did come from Labour.
Those with the broadest shoulders should pay their fair share. After looking at the issue over many months, I've concluded that we can indeed. We can indeed introduce a system which is both fairer and remains competitive with other countries. So the government will abolish the current tax system for non-DOMs.
It could make £2 billion for the government.
This isn't just a question that the UK is grappling with, I guess. I mean, lots of other countries around the world must have a similar quandary. Are there any examples where they've done something which maybe we should consider over here?
There were actually a number of countries in the OECD, which is a group of wealthy nations, about 38 countries. About 12 of those had wealth taxes in 1990, but now it's just three: Spain, Switzerland, and Norway.
Why is that?
I think that many countries abandoned them because they were perceived to be unpopular. So Stuart Adam from the Institute for Fiscal Studies said that he thought that was because they were economically damaging, administratively cumbersome, which we've spoken about, and prone to avoidance and evasion while not actually delivering much revenue. So he felt that nations which introduced them found that it just wasn't worth it in the end. I think that if you look at Switzerland and Norway, Norway doesn't have inheritance tax. So that's one reason why they might get away with having a wealth tax instead. It's because people aren't being taxed on assets when they die. And I think Switzerland, it depends on the canton that you're in, the region. They all have different rules, but generally you don't have to pay capital gains or inheritance tax either.
From Switzerland, back to Gary in rainy London. He might be for a wealth tax, and as a result, less popular with some of his old mates on the trading floor, but does he miss the life that made him rich?
Well, I don't miss 5:30 a.m. alarm clocks, I'll tell you that for sure. There are some things I miss for sure, you know. I was a very, very successful trader at a very young age. I was very well known. You know, you walk into that trading floor, it's a huge floor. Everyone's got these big screens, wealthy men, powerful men. And they look across at you and they say, that's the guy, he's the best trader in the room.
You must still dabble in trading a little bit, surely.
I do. Listen, for me to stop trading, it would be like you stopping watching the news. Trading and watching the markets is how I understand the world. Now I work in the media. To come out here in the media environment, being right doesn't really get you anywhere. And that's very frustrating for me because I don't want to see this country collapse into poverty. So, you know, I miss being in a space where it was enough just to be right.
You have been listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times with me, Luke Jones, and my guests, Lily Russell-Jones, senior money reporter at The Times and Sunday Times, and Gary Stevenson, economist, millionaire former trader, and author of The Trading Game, A Confession. Today's producer was Olivia Case. The executive producers were Kate Ford and James Shield, and sound design was by Mau Lasseto. If you're game for more of this kind of thing, go and listen to our episode on the latest Sunday Times Rich List. It is full of fascinating nuggets. You'll find a link to it in the description of this episode. Send us an email if you have any thoughts on any of this. If you have a suggestion maybe for something we should cover, you can get in touch at storiesofourtimes@thetimes.co.uk. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.